North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese are engaged. And General Abrams reports that there's been a 55% decrease in truck traffic south into South Vietnam, which means that those trucks that do not go south will not carry the arms and the men that will be killing Americans. Now, we can all, of course, here in a press conference, we can debate as to whether or not my view of it is right or the rest. I hope for the good of the country mine is, and if it is right, what you say now doesn't make any difference. I'm only suggesting, while the jury is still out, remember, the purpose of this, like the purpose of Cambodia, is to reduce American forces, to reduce our casualties. And I should point out that that's exactly what this administration has done. We've kept every promise that we've made. We've reduced our forces. We have reduced our casualties. We're going to continue to reduce our forces. And we are getting out of Vietnam in a way that Vietnam will be able to defend itself. Mr. Healy.
Mr. President, terrorists in Turkey have kidnapped four of our flyers and are holding them for $400,000 ransom. Do you think the Turkish government should negotiate with the terrorists, and is there anything that you think we can or should do in a situation like this?
Mr. Healy, we've had that situation with several other governments, and I would not suggest that the Turkish government negotiate on this matter, because I believe that's a decision that that government must make, having in mind its own internal situation. Simple.
If I may turn to the Middle East just for a minute. The Arabs have reportedly agreed to sign a peace treaty with Israel in exchange for certain withdrawals by Israel from territory occupied in 1967. Is it not now time for the Israelis to make some concessions of their own, and will you be asking them publicly or privately to do so?
Well, Mr. Semple, as you well know, because you're sophisticated in this area, the question there is whether or not the United States will impose a settlement in the Mideast, and the answer is no. We will do everything that we can to urge the parties to talk. And incidentally, when we talk about the problems in the Mideast, let it not go unnoted that we've made some progress. There was 4 years of fighting up until August of last year, and for 7 months, no guns have fired in the Mideast. That is progress of a kind. We hope that the truce fire, either by agreement or de facto, will be extended. We hope that the Israelis and the Egyptians, and for that matter, the Jordanians, will continue some kind of discussion. As far as imposing a settlement, however, we can only say that we can make suggestions, but we are going to have to depend upon the parties concerned to reach an agreement. And we, of course, will be there to see that the balance of power is maintained in the Mideast, which we will continue to do, because if that balance changes, that could bring on war. And also, we are prepared, as I've indicated, to join other major powers, including the Soviet Union, in guaranteeing any settlement that is made, which would give Israel the security of its borders that it might not get through geographical acquisition.
You said earlier that about Communist China, at least you were not perfectly clear about your position on Communist China, about seating in the United Nations. Somebody asked you if you would favor a two-China policy, but you were not completely clear about that. Could you say, sir, if Taiwan maintained its position in the Security Council, if it maintained its position in the United Nations, if you would favor seating Communist China?
That's a moot question at this time, because Communist China, or the People's Republic of China, which I understand stirred up people in Taiwan because that is the official name of the country, but Communist China refuses even to discuss the matter. Therefore, it would not be appropriate for me to suggest what we might agree to when Communist China takes the position that they will have no discussion whatever until Taiwan gets out, and we will not start with that kind of a proposition. Mr. Warren.
Mr. President, a few months back you were quite optimistic about the successful conclusion of SALT talks. Are you less optimistic now?
I am just as optimistic now as I was then about the eventual success. As you will note from our world policy report, the two great superpowers now have nuclear parity. Neither can gain an advantage over the other if the other desires to see to it that that does not occur. Now, under these circumstances, therefore, it is in the interests of both powers to negotiate some kind of limitation on offensive and defensive weapons. We will be stating a position on that on March 15, when the new talks begin in Vienna. As far as when an agreement is reached, I will not indicate optimism or pessimism. As far as the eventuality of an agreement, my belief is that the seriousness of the talks, the fact that there are great forces, the danger of war, the escalating costs, and the fact that neither power can gain an advantage over the others, I think that this means that there will be an agreement eventually between the United States and the Soviet Union. Yes, sir. Yes, and I should add that I know that the suggestion has been made that we might negotiate a separate agreement on defensive weapons alone. We reject that proposal. We will negotiate an agreement that is not comprehensive, but it must include offensive as well as defensive weapons, some mix.
Mr. President, I'd like to go back for a moment to your first answer, in which you said that what's happened in Laos has already assured more troop withdrawals. Were you saying that on the basis of what you obviously consider success in the Laotian operation will allow you to withdraw American troops at least the present rate, 12,500 men a month for 12 months?
What I am saying, Mr. Kaplow, is that our troop withdrawal schedule will go forward at least at the present rate. It will go forward for at least the present rate, and when I make the announcement on in April, that will, of course, will cover several months in advance. More important, however, is the troop withdrawal schedule for next year, because as you will note in my foreign policy report, at least the oral report I made, I pointed out that the Laotian operation this year would save American lives by destroying or capturing equipment that otherwise might move into ICOR, where a number of Americans are located, and that next year it would serve to guarantee the continued success of our withdrawal program. The more that the disruption of the complex of trails leading from North Vietnam to South Vietnam occurs in the operation now being conducted on the ground by the South Vietnamese in southern Laos, the more that that occurs, the more successful that it is, the greater the possibility that the United States may be able to increase the rate of its troop withdrawal. I'm not prepared to make that decision yet, but we can say at this time the troop withdrawal will continue at its present level. I can say incidentally that even since the Laotian operation began, with all the news, 10,000 Americans have come home in this period.
Mr. President.
I'm sorry, we run out of time.
You've been listening to President Nixon's news conference on foreign policy matters. It was broadcast live from Washington. The main questions asked of the president concerned the war in Indochina, and the question of most interest was about the possibility of an invasion of North Vietnam.
WBAI New York. WBAI New York.
The president subdivided that question into three questions of his own. What will President Tiu do? What will the United States do? And what will we do together? On the first question, what will President Tew do? He said, we won't speculate on that. The second question, what will the United States do? He said that air power might be used against North Vietnam to destroy surface-to-air missile sites there. He also said that if, in his opinion, there is increased infiltration from North Vietnam into South Vietnam, he, at his discretion, that is the president, might consider attacking North Vietnamese supply routes. As to what the United States and South Vietnam would do together, he said that that the plan being speculated about was that South Vietnam would invade North Vietnam on the ground under the cover of U.S. air power. The president answered that aspect of the question by simply saying no such plan is under consideration. As for the current operations in Laos, the president said that the operations both in Cambodia and Laos were made to reduce American casualties. It might be noted that 69 Americans died in the war last week. That's the highest weekly fatality toll in 6 months. This is Paul Fisher.
This has been a special report from the Public Affairs Department of WBAI FM, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio in New York City.
New funeral.
Servicemen who fought for a year each in Vietnam. Both were assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division. Perkins is a combat engineer, Reynolds is a helicopter door gunner. This interview was recorded in July of this year. The interviewer is Bill Schechner, and his is the first voice. He's talking with Pete Perkins.
What kind of orientation did you get, not about your job, which is another whole area we could talk about training. What kind of orientation did you get about what kind of civilian customs you were going to encounter and what to expect from the people and how to interpret their actions so that you would understand what they were trying, you know, if you went into a village and you'd understand what they were trying to get across to you, assuming that there wasn't anyone there who spoke really, you know, fluent English?
Well, in your basic training, you're given this big fear pitch about the entire place. Like you're taught to suspect everyone as being, you know, carrying a gun and about ready to shoot you if you turn your back on them.
How do they substantiate that? I mean, what kind of thing? Just an NCO stands up and tells you that?
Yeah, he says more or less that nobody can be trusted, you know. They may look like they're not up to anything, but in reality they're planning on, you know, getting you some way, some devious way. So the fellas, when they go over there, they're usually pretty scared of the whole situation when they get there. Like the fellas who are new in the field are the ones who are mainly, or let's say, a lot responsible for the, you know, the trigger happiness, that sort of thing. Shooting before there's really any cause to, or shooting when you haven't been shot at and all that sort of thing. Like the group at My Lai was, like most of them had been there less than 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I'm sure that was pretty well responsible for the degree in which they got into that sort of thing.
What kind of things do they tell you before you actually link up with whatever unit you're going to over there about the population itself? Do they, does the Army have an official position about, not official on paper, but in the course of the stuff, the orientation briefings and the lectures. I think I should say I've been in the Army to the extent of being in the reserve program. And when you speak about orientations and lectures, at least when I was in basic training, it was totally unlike what a civilian would think of as a lecture. The level of instruction, put it that way, is extremely low. I mean, people sort of yell at you and give you pat answers for pat questions, following outlines. It's not like a college or high school lecture where somebody stands up and tries to give you information. It's getting through a block of material. It's still the same way, I presume, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they'll do as much as possible, actually, to deal in a stereotype rather than to try to examine the issues, you know, what is behind the Viet Cong and the NLF drive for liberation. They want to avoid, really, at all costs, any penetrating analysis of the problem. They just want you to go out there and look upon the people as, you know, small little people and not really as human beings, you know, not as complex people that they are.
Can you remember some of the stereotypes that they, some of the kinds of information they gave you?
Well, first of all, I ought to point out that they're almost never referred to as Vietnamese. I mean, most everybody knows this. They're either referred to as gooks or as slants or something.
Even
something
here.
Racist of this nature.
Even in this country?
Yeah, most of the GIs coming back still carry these terms around and use them.
What do they tell you about the Vietnamese people's living habits? Do they lead you to expect that? What's the stereotype as far as you perceived it, and how does it jibe with what you actually find once you get there?
Well, I guess they give you this preconception that they sit around in these ragged little huts and brew up something with rice every night, and actually that's not really far off. They do. Most of the people live in hamlets, and the quarters and the housing and that is just grass shack sort of thing for the most part. And the food is, you know, heavily spiced rice dishes and that. And you're told to keep away from this because presumably there might be something infectious in the food or this. But it gets down to they don't want any real significant cultural exchanges. Like, you know, the idea of people eating together seems a little bit too much of a real exchange for them to want to have happen. And occasionally this guys who do, you know, they get to realizing what the struggle is all about, and they of course become less loyal to what the Army lifers have to say at that point.
Do they tell you, besides the fact that civilians are liable to be that all civilians are liable to be enemy. Do they give you any idea of civilian customs within the population? That is, what Vietnamese might be doing as you observe them? I'm trying to remember. I remember an article that I read, or maybe it was in Cy Hirsch's book about My Lai, and I can't remember the detail of it, in which something which is very normal, part of Vietnamese life, was transformed in the eyes of the army into being a very sinister custom. And I just don't remember what it was. I wish I could, because it'd make a good example.
You see, you only get a look really at one section of the population when you go into villages or anything. You never find any adult military-aged males around. All you find is women, because the men are either, they've either gone into the Arvin Army, have been drafted into that, and they spend all their time in some encampment, or they're out in the hills with the Viet Cong. They're one place or the other. They're never in the villages. And relationships you see are the relationships of women with their children, and they're pretty much what you'd expect them to be.
Well, what happens then when you compare that with the warnings that everybody's a possible enemy?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. There have been times when, you know, women have shot at people and children have thrown hand grenades and all that stuff, but It's a lot less likely than they'd like you to think. And
did it ever happen to you?
No, I never had a got shot at by a woman or had a kid throw a hand grenade at me. I had the first occasion I had to have dealings with Vietnamese people. I'd been there about a month. And what they like to do to kind of throw a scare into the new engineers coming in was to have us guard prisoners of war. So they told me I was guarding prisoners of war. I figured I ought to get all shook up about that. And at first I was, you know, really felt intimidated that I should be guarding prisoners of war. But what it was there were these were a bunch of kids for the most part. There were about 20 fellas who were prisoners of war, and only, I would say only about three or four of them were over 15. Most of them were 10 to 12 and in that age group. And what I was supposed to do with them was to see that they filled up sandbags. So I just sat there and watched them fill sandbags. I didn't, you know, try to harass them or anything. And they, it was just like an ordinary bunch of school children, you know. That's what it was for the most part. Was, and, you know, they give you this impression of a Viet Cong as being such a hardcore type. He, you know, it came down from Hanoi and he's had, you know, 20 years of karate and this and that and the other. And you get to think that they're, you know, they're really some way out type of cat, you know. But in reality, most of the actual work is done by just interested kids who go out and plant punji stakes and things like that. So, but I was real surprised that, you know, that you never, hardly ever get to come in contact with, you know, full-fledged and known and hardcore Viet Cong and all that. And that most of the actual combat forces in that are just a bunch of kids in that.
This is WBAI in New York, and I'm Bill Schechner, and I'm talking with Pete Perkins, who spent a year, better than a year, right?
Just a year.
Just a year. Did one tour of duty in Vietnam with the 1st Air Cavalry, 1st Cavalry Air Mobile Division. He was a combat engineer. We're talking about the war as viewed by a serviceman who actually was involved in the fighting, as opposed to, I hope, as opposed to as viewed by Army briefers or Pentagon experts or civilians who passed through for a junket of 2 weeks. The kids that you were talking about, how did they get, how were they captured? Do you know?
They weren't really captured. They were just
rounded up.
Like, yeah, rounded up, seen going somewhere out of the village at night, or suspected of going somewhere out of the village at night, things like this. And they were just, they were branded, and of course they had to, at that point they had to be on this detail that filled sandbags, and they spent 8 hours a day filling sandbags and everything. But
they were stuck as prisoners of war. I mean,
yeah, they were considered prisoners of war, and they were treated as prisoners of war. I had a gun, which in the event of one of them doing anything, I would have been obliged to use. I don't know. I don't believe I would have. I mean, if one of them had run away, I'd have just said, to hell with it and let him go on, you know.
What kind of pressure is there to take prisoners of war such as these? Is that something which looks good on a record?
Yeah, well, there was one thing that happened just at the same time. We were having them fill sandbags in an area that we were using as a sump. And, like, all the garbage from the landing zone got dumped there. And at night, people would come around and raid the sump, you know. There could be live ammunition and things like that in there, which they wanted. And it was another
thing. Were they picking through there for food? Or?
They were. I was just going to say that it was really incredible the way that they'd go after dumped away garbage. I things like eggs that were thrown out of the mess hall and that, they would, you know, they'd gather that up. And it's really not, it's not that hurting a country for food. They've got rice and stuff like that. I couldn't imagine what they wanted with throwing away GI garbage. But the idea, I suppose they were more interested in picking up things of military value.
Mm-hmm.
But one night, prior to the actual fall of night, some people were down there starting early. And we were told to go over and kick them out and, you know, drive them back into the hills and that sort of thing. So we were doing this, and at one point I took off down a trail and I was, you know, chasing people back and that. And it wasn't really a very difficult thing to do, just yell at them a little bit. And about, I don't know, about 16 kids or so came walking down the trail with their hands up as if to say, what they really wanted to do was just go back home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And all these were kids. I mean, there was nobody there over 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have been listed as prisoners of war. What happened was they were turned over to some MPs, and then some funky interpreter came along and harassed them and that, and just let them go back to their village. But it's incredible what the lengths that we go to keep people from, you know, raiding a sump. That's really ridiculous, in my opinion.
What happens on a search and destroy mission?
Well, I've participated in some of those. What usually happens is you bivouac at night close to a village, like say within a quarter or half a mile of a village, and you get up actually before the crack of dawn, and you go through a field or something, and then you come onto this village right at dawn. And you rummage through, and you're told always to be on the alert.
WBAI, New York.
There could be a whole battalion of Viet Cong in there, and all that. So that when you go in, you're scared and you're apprehensive, and you're apt to shoot at anything which makes a sudden movement.
What are your orders?
As
far as shooting goes?
As far as shooting, you're not supposed to shoot unless you're fired upon, or you're supposed to shoot at people who are running away, assuming that these are Viet Cong running away from you.
Would it, my first reaction to that is to say that people who are running away from you are probably scared of you. As
right.
opposed to your enemies, is that, I mean,
right.
is that fair?
A lot of times it's women who just don't want to be around when you're coming in there and to harass them. And when you do come in, all of the women come out of their huts and they kind of band together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they don't want to be found alone inside of a hut by some GI in early morning hours.
Mm-hmm.
For fairly obvious reasons.
What kind of interpreters does a search and destroy, does a unit on a search and destroy mission have with it?
Generally, they don't have any interpreters. They just grab a few people and, you know, generally harass them. They can't speak any Vietnamese, the guys themselves, but they just kind of, they make vague innuendos, like they grab a woman and they say UVC and stuff like this, and then the women say no VC, and then the GIs say UVC, and this little game goes on for a couple minutes, and then they move on, mess around with somebody else, and really there's hardly, it's just a game, that's all it is.
How many, how big is a normal hamlet? How many huts?
Well, usually there's only about 50 or 60 people in a hamlet, and that'll be a couple dozen huts, I'd say, for the most part. And they're very picturesque places. They're usually surrounded by coconut groves and things like this. And when we do come in, we often come in with tanks and APCs and literally run over the coconut.
An APC is an armored personnel carrier.
Yeah, armored personnel carrier.
Which looks like a tank.
It looks like a tank, right. And it does about the same job. Like, if you come in and you run over some rice fields, you're usually destroying land that is really difficult to culture. The growing of rice, you have to have the water level at the proper level at all times. And it's I guess most people know this, it's really intricate the way they have them banked and levied and that, and then we just casually go through them with a tank and destroy what takes several years actually to perfect. And it has to be right all the time, because once you smash a levee, the water that's supposed to be exactly 4 inches tall, it runs off and it's 1 inch